Hello. In this ASI cast, Richard Marks interviews Guy Bisson, Research Director at Ampere Analysis, about the progress the large global SVOD services have made in the last year. Guy emphasises how the commitment shown to producing high-quality original content is changing the relationship with pay TV operators. And in the search for younger consumers, channel brands too are having to modify their strategies to meet the new challenge.
So welcome back to the podcast. It's been, since September 2016, since we last spoke, Guy. So I think the main focus when we spoke back in September 2016 was on the SVOD services and particularly consumer reactions to them. So I thought it'd be a good point perhaps to leap in, at least initially continue that discussion. I mean, looking specifically at the large global SVOD players, how have they been faring since we last spoke?
I think it will be news to no one that they've been faring pretty well. As global platforms, both Netflix and Amazon are pretty successful. Obviously, it varies by country and territories, and they each have certain key markets which are strong for them. But I think in terms of their position within the consumer perception as a whole, we're seeing in our data that is rising all the time. As brands, they are rising in consumer perception as the way that people think of the service they provide and the content that they provide, and as a destination for increasingly high quality content. I think all of that has been on the rise since we last spoke. And of course, that positions them competitively much more strongly even than when we last spoke.
Well, obviously, taking Netflix and Amazon Prime as the two main SVOD services, they've both got very different objectives, although they have got one thing in common, which I'll come on to in a moment. But in terms of their specific objectives, it's for Netflix, it's obviously all about subscriptions. And for Amazon, it's about tying people into Amazon Prime. How successful are each of them in their specific objectives, do you think?
You're right. They're different in their objectives. I mean, I think the defining factor is that Netflix is a pure play content and distribution business. Amazon, of course, is not just a retailer. They're a massive technology company as well. And Amazon Prime is part of both of those strategies, both retail and broadcast tech. You know, it does different things for them. For Netflix, it's about competing or complementing, in some cases, pay television. For Amazon, as you say, it's about bringing on high-value Prime customers who then spend more with the platform. The difference, of course, is that Amazon can go ahead and never make any money specifically from the video and still have that as a going concern, whereas Netflix obviously needs to be making or start to make money. I think that you'll see the difference mainly in their content investment. So specifically original content, both have an original content strategy, but Netflix is considerably bigger than Amazon, and I'm sure will remain considerably bigger and grow at a much faster rate because it's absolutely core to that pure play business, whereas Amazon can take slightly more leisurely pace around its content strategy.
Of course, what they've both got in common, I mean, obviously they want to drive up reach to achieve their objectives, but neither of them is particularly dependent on advertising. Yes. And in the light of the last couple of weeks, specifically the Facebook Cambridge Analytica problems, but also the last couple of years in terms of the controversy in Adland around everything to do with ad visibility, brand safety, and so on. Do you think that they've got an inherent advantage, and you could probably add Apple into that as well, in that their business model is not reliant on advertising and effectively, you know, selling their customers to the highest bidder? Do you think that that's got an appeal to analysts, that perhaps city analysts, that might actually be benefiting them going forward?
That's a little harder to answer. I think the grass is always greener. If you're a pay TV company or subscription business, you want to have a finger in the advertising pie, and vice versa. If you're advertising, you certainly want to be establishing subscription businesses. So it's always a balance. I think fundamentally, at the price point that Netflix is at in particular, the subscription model is very good for them. We've done a little, not quite back of the envelope, a bit more sophisticated than that, but a little bit of modeling around what would happen if they switched to an ad model. And the interesting thing is, if Netflix had switched to an advertising model 5 years ago when it was at peak viewing, it would have made a little bit more money than it does from the subscription business, assuming it didn't lose loads of customers. If you do that same calculation today, it would actually make less money from a full switch to a TV-like ad load around its content. The reason is, as the SVOD market has diversified and people tend now to have two or three services in their household, the viewing per service, of course, is declining, which then impacts the advertising revenue available to any one service. Now, Netflix is still high. Our data shows about, in an SVOD household, about 2 hours of viewing a day. If that's just Netflix, then that all goes to Netflix. But as soon as you get two or three services, you're looking at 30 or 40 minutes per service. And then the ad model makes less sense. But, of course, it doesn't stop diversification. So what we saw in the channel business, if you think backwards 20 years, was maybe you started with a core brand and then you launched a family or sister channels to that, some of which could be advertising supported. So, you know, core Netflix, we don't think will carry advertising, but it doesn't mean in the future they might not launch Netflix version 2 sister channel that is ad supported. You know,
similar to perhaps Spotify with the sort of paid service and an ad supported sort of gateway service, as it were.
Potentially with different content strategies. So you might keep the premium high budget drama on one, and the other might be more light entertainment. All these options are available going forward as the SVOD players assume the position of the traditional subscription channels, increasingly so, not just in the consumer mind, but in the business chain as a whole.
Did your model make any assumptions around whether a Netflix with advertising would actually lose subscribers because not having advertising might be seen by some as a core brand value?
Yes, so we assumed the calculation that looked at the balance between subscription and advertising assumed zero churn, which of course is not particularly realistic. In fact, what you could argue is if it was free, they'd actually get more customers. But the calculation worked out that they'd have to get about 56% more customers to make the same amount of money. So they'd go, if they went free, they'd have to grow the customer base quite substantially to make the same amount of money from advertising.
Of course, the other thing Netflix are doing at the moment to grow the customer base is that they are taking an increasingly bundled approach in some markets, doing deals with platforms, most recently in the last few weeks, Sky in the UK. I can see the benefits for Netflix in terms of, you know, being everywhere and getting as many customers as they can. I'm less sure about the long-term benefit for the platforms. What's your view on the benefits to Sky in terms of an arrangement like that? Is it not actually highlighting to Sky customers that a lot of the great content isn't necessarily on Sky anymore?
Yeah, I think it comes back to what we said at the top of the call, that the position of Netflix has risen to a point where, and the brand strength of Netflix and the perception around its content is now at a point that Sky effectively has to have it on platform. So it's an admission by Sky that the market has evolved, that they can't control all of the content, all of the sport, all of the movies, all of the best series. They do need to work with the strongest brands in the market, and Netflix is one of those very strong brands that brings that perception to Sky, that it's the place to go for high-end drama. Sky Atlantic has been their core strategy around that, with the HBO content and some ABC content, but Netflix is now part of that, and it will be bundled into a traditional TV package. Other operators as well. A few weeks before Sky, OSN in the Middle East announced a similar deal. In fact, we've been saying it for about a decade that this was the way the market had to head. And I remember standing up at Cable Congress 10 years ago suggesting this and literally seeing people laugh in the room. And I think now there's an acceptance in that traditional pay TV space that you need to bring the strong content brands on platform, and that's what it's all about. And we're going to see much more of it.
In Singapore, you're going to be talking quite specifically about how channel brands can remain competitive in this new black battleground. We talked about platforms, but obviously, particularly with younger consumers who are increasing their consumption of SVOD, the concern for the channel brands is how to have a piece of that action, as it were. In the US, CBS, I'm particularly interested because they've launched a premium SVOD channel, CBS All Access, and on that you get not just access to their sort of box sets, but you also get content you can't actually get on their broadcast channel, like the new Star Trek series and sequel to The Good Wife. Is there any early intelligence on how that broadcaster approach is working?
So we can see quite clearly in our data that and not just for paid services like CBS All Access, but for any catch-up service run by a broadcaster, people who are engaging with that streamed service have a much better perception of the core broadcast channel in terms of the way they rate it on a net promoter basis, and they also watch the channel more. So the benefits of having any associated branded streaming service alongside your channel are very, very clear. Having a finger in that pie brings you higher viewing, higher perception of content and brand. So it's very important to be there. In terms of the strategy that you've talked about with CBS, I mean, clearly that's a paid-for add-on, but a number of broadcasters are putting exclusive content into their catch-up services, even into the free ones. So Channel 4 in the UK, for example, with some of the Walter Presents stream of content, we call it augmented catch-up. And I think it's absolutely key to bring that younger demographic in, give them something that's unique to that platform, hook them into that streaming service, and hopefully then bring them also to the linear brand to watch in a more traditional way as well. So it's core as a stream.
Do you think the challenge is that most broadcasters tend to be in a particular country, or I'm loath to use the word local, but local in the sense of national broadcasters? How does that strategy work when you move outside? I mean, the irony is that the new Star Trek series, which you get on CBS and All Access in the States, has been sold to Netflix in the rest of the world, had all the CBS branding taken off it. And as far as anyone in the UK outside the TV industry is concerned, Star Trek is now a Netflix show.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big question in the content industry at the moment, whether you should work with Netflix and co-produce with Netflix, because if you're a channel and a local channel, as you say, and you've really only got one home market, it can be very attractive to get a very high budget show with Netflix that Netflix then takes for the rest of the world. The flip side of that is you're potentially helping a competitor localize content in your home market as well. So it's a balance. A number of broadcasters are working with Netflix on co-production, selling the rights then to Netflix internationally. But I think there's an increasing question being raised over that strategy from the broadcasters, but also from Netflix, because I think Netflix is increasingly looking to bring everything in-house. And we'll do less and less co-production, because as a global platform, control of the rights in every market is absolutely core to them. And the original content, branded original, whether it is genuinely original or not, has become so important to their wider strategy it's important to them to control it fully.
So ironically, that could be good news for the broadcasters and for companies like Sky, because without fixating on Star Trek, it struck me that that's exactly the sort of series that would have been on Sky 10 years ago without thinking about it. The premium US shows would be hoovered up, The Simpsons, Star Trek, and that was a big driver in the early days for people to be adopting Sky. Whereas if the US broadcasters did go down the model of just dumping all their global content onto Netflix, that would be a huge problem for Sky going forward, I guess. The question I'd have is around HBO. There's been vague talk of possibly HBO Go, the US online service for HBO, being extended into other markets. Could you see a situation where Sky Atlantic ceased to exist on Sky at some point, or is that a fairly fixed part of the Sky offer, do you think?
I think it's pretty fixed. Sky, of course, has its own very extensive original production strategy. They've also been quite open about the fact that they're going to expand into more international markets with a streaming service. And they've already done that in Spain, for example, but that's going to go further. I think what we'll see, and what we have clearly seen with things like the potential Disney-Fox deal, is more and more people thinking about retaining their rights potentially to use in global or large pan-regional services of their own. So Disney Fox is an example. Sky, of course, whatever brand they choose when they roll out on a more international basis, but they've invested heavily in original content specifically for that purpose, to control the rights in a large geographic area. And it's a big difference from 10 years ago, as you say, when a pay TV operator like Sky was driven by a sport and Hollywood movies primarily. Drama was important, but a lot of it was, a lot of the Star Treks of this world were on free-to-air television. Now we're seeing the high-end drama increasingly in that pay space. It's become a very important competitive battleground, and we can see in the drivers for consumers as well, particularly younger consumers, the growing importance of drama and TV type content at the expense often of sport and to a degree movies. So it's a very interesting time.
I noticed I was at the same event as you earlier in the week, where there was a presentation about esports and the huge impact that's having on young people, people actually going to sports arena to watch people playing video games live, as it were, which makes you wonder again how much that will impact the importance of sport for the younger generations, proper sport, as it were, but also whether someone will wake up to how you monetize the global rights to video games, whether the broadcast rights for those will start to inflate as people wake up to the whole idea of people watching other people playing video games being something very attractive to young people. But, do you think, how permanent do you think this focus on drama is at the moment? Is it a natural transition from the Hollywood sort of movie model to the box set continuing drama model, or is it, do you think, sort of something that may burst at some point? There must be a limit to how much quality drama there is out there before everyone's investigated every format and every decent actor out there is in every TV show.
Just to clarify at the beginning, Hollywood movies are still key, of course, and indeed sport is still key. It's just it's gradual shifts at the margins, specifically on the drama bubble. You know, I actually ask that question myself whenever I speak to a content producer. And I think the wider view in the market is that the demand at the moment is so high that you simply can't produce enough. There's no bubble. It's the supply and demand is imbalanced. As you've alluded to, one of the potential bottlenecks is a talent bottleneck. So we have seen a lot of movie talent move into drama in a lot of countries, and that trend I'm sure will continue. But you know, as a format, let's come back to Netflix. Where's this drama interest and this massive surge of investment in high-end drama come from? It's been influenced by Netflix and the ability to binge view, and the way that people are, you know, all of that is new, and it's so easy to forget that 5-10 years ago, nobody binged view. There was no option to binge view. The way that drama was structured, even narratively and in its story arc, was different because it was produced to be watched one episode a week over an extended number of months. And now the complexity of the stories, the character development, the production value, all of that has shifted as a result of the changing dynamics in the industry. And I think that's why it's become more competitive to that traditional movie content, because of the way it has evolved. And I do think we've got the likes of Netflix to thank, I guess, for that change.
Well, I was reading a book about TV production in the 80s, where they were talking to some of the writers who used to say that they actually used to try and sneak continuity into the American drama series, because the network TV bosses would be furious, because they basically wanted a TV show that you could throw all 80 shows up in the air and put them in any order and people could still watch them, because continuity might sort of alienate viewers, which is almost the antithesis of where we've got to with things like Game of Thrones at the moment, with where you almost need a spreadsheet just to work out what's going on. But I guess the attraction is that you can hook people, and once you've hooked someone on Game of Thrones, you've hooked them on, you know, 80, 90 hours of content and the related advertising and the related subscription money. So an interesting evolution from 10, 15 years ago, when we were being told that basically the future was, you know, reality TV, because it was so damn cheap.
Yes, yes.
Anyway, on that note, we'll hold back on a further talk about particularly channel brands and how they deal with SVOD for your paper in Singapore, which we're very much looking forward to in the second week of May. And we'll catch up with you then. So thanks for making the time to speak to us today, Guy, and we'll see you next month.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, then check out past episodes at asiconferences.com. And if you have a topic you'd like to discuss in a future ASI cast, then do let us know.